Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. Connect the Dots makes a connection between your personal health and experience and your total health environment, and that includes your community, your family, your society, and the global ecology from which all life springs here on planet Earth. Every week, we talk about different facets of this and see how it all interconnects. In our society, I've been a health and science reporter, journalist, and book author for 2 decades plus. I'm also a health coach and a facilitator of family constellation work. So I've been in the healing arts and communicating and writing about them, reporting on all of the ramifications of our social policies in terms of everything that affects health for going on 2+ decades at this point in time. And one of the things that happens is that because we have a society with so much fragmentation, we look at things in bits and parts, and we have a science that looks at tiny pieces, but we don't know how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again and see where everything fits. And so that's our weekly theme here on Connect the Dots, is looking at different facets and how they interact with others and what the big picture could begin to look like if we can see these connections and expand our vision. And we explore that every week on this show in different ways. Today we have a terrific show that I'm very excited to be bringing to you. And in addition, I begin every week, every program, with an activist opportunity to protect our health, food, environment, and protect the health of our society. So today we're going to talk again about protecting the, it's a subject I've covered many times, which is fracking. We're talking about it specifically in terms of some very urgent action in New York State, where I reside, and New York City is where the show is based, although it goes nationally and internationally. The whole network is, originates in a small studio in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. So today we're talking again in our featured action, before we move on to our guest, about protecting and preserving the water, air, food, and natural wild environment of New York, where we source all of our urban centers downstream, source water, air, and food from these agricultural and rural regions in the north of New York City and Philadelphia and other big cities. This is currently under threat because after many years of kind of sitting on the fence and putting forth some rather inadequate potential guidelines, New York's Governor Cuomo has put forth a plan to start fracking and drilling in several counties of New York State. So this is really a critical time for people who are concerned to let him know your concerns and to try to put a stop to this. And, you know, because of the fragmented thinking that we have so prevalently in our society, everyone will tend to think, well, if it's not in my backyard, if it's not happening in my neighborhood, it isn't happening to me. But, you know, the earth doesn't really know the kinds of boundaries that we think in terms of, and things like water and air don't stay within a specific line. They flow up in the air, they flow in flooding, they flow underground, and they travel and bring things like the toxic chemicals used in fracking, the radioactivity released in fracking gas can travel, can be pipelined down to urban centers, and all of this can affect your health. And it also can pollute the agricultural regions that local sustainable food comes from. So, you know, we tend to just kind of be really sort of short-sighted in all our thinking, and, you know, this is part of connecting the dots and broadening the picture. Actually, in Pennsylvania State, which is our neighboring state and which has had fracking for several years, in the last 3 years, they've had almost 3,500 violations and of, you know, what the very minimal regulations, because this has been deregulated under former Vice President Cheney. But basically, even with those minimal regulations, and Pennsylvania State has tried to roll back any regulations, there have been nearly 3,500 violations in the last 3 years, and this really exceeds the capacity of a government in these times of budget cuts to monitor. So we're taking some real risks here. So now I'm going to point you to some sites where you can, websites where you can learn more, where you can take action to learn more about the violations and some conflicts of interest between government officials and gas industry executives. You can go to the following two websites, Damascus, D-A-M-A-S-C-U-S, citizens.org, Catskillcitizens.org, and the Catskill Citizens website has a link to the Environmental Working Group study of government collusion with gas industry, and we know in these times, also connecting the dots, that powerful and wealthy industries do lean on people who run for public office through, and they have influence through financial contributions. So that's something else that, you know, should not have us resting easy about the kinds of decisions that are being made, and that's why participation is needed. You can also take action very easily by going to New York, it's NY, againstfracking.org, and there is a simple click, whole bunch of actions you can take to give feedback to New York's governor. So that's our featured action, and you know, we'll probably be featuring this again along with food and some of the other kinds of areas that we regularly feature activism for. And now we'll make shift and go forward to speak with the guest that I have to welcome to today's show. I'm really, really thrilled to be speaking today with Francesca Mason Boring. She is just an amazing woman. She's written recently a book called Connecting to Our Ancestral Past. She's the author of several previous books, Feather Medicine, Walking in Shoshone Dreamtime, is one, and as well as this recent book, which is published by North Atlantic Books, and just being released this past month. Francesca Mason Boring is bicultural. She's an enrolled member of the Shoshone Nation, and she's a facilitator internationally, as well as a trainer of other facilitators in a method which we've featured on the show before and will feature again, called family constellation work. One of her specific areas of specialty is in doing this unique work, which we'll learn about more later on in the program, as ceremony. So this is really a beautiful interface between healing and multiple levels. Francesca has also basically focused a great deal as well on nature constellations, and I think that's very relevant to the environmental themes often covered here on our program. So welcome, Fran. I'm so happy to have you with us today and connect the dots.
Allison, thank you very much for inviting me to the conversation, and I really appreciate people that are tuning in. I really love the title of your show, Connecting the Dots. Pardon me. For me, that's so much what constellation work is about, and that you have a focus on nature, that you're a facilitator already in constellation work, but I think essentially a facilitator in that same field long before we were really aware of constellations. I feel really fortunate to be able to share something that I hope that people will be able to immediately use.
That sounds terrific. Now let's kind of give a little bit of context, because I think that how shall I say it? It's like having written as I have for several decades, offering health counsel, health recommendations, pointing people to health resources, studying and practicing them myself. One thing that's really glaringly obvious to me is that we often are just looking at ourselves. Obviously, you know, if I'm in duress, then there will be duress in, you know, in multiple ways that can express throughout life in many different ways. And, of course, it's good. It's positive. It's not a bad thing to begin with oneself. But so often that creates a kind of feedback loop where we begin with you know, self-healing in some kind of way. And again, I want to reiterate, that's the place to begin. If you try to jump over that, you're not going to go very far. So it's an essential place to begin, but unfortunately people get stuck there. So, you know, in our culture, there's kind of myth of the self-made person. You know, I've created my reality. I've, according to this belief, I'm not saying this, but I've created my reality. I've chosen my parents, or I've sprung up full-blown apart from them, rejecting the negative lessons or toxicity that they contributed to me. You know, there's this whole, even when we go to do work of healing, there's a sense that in the Western culture that this is done in isolation, and then I can either, you know, be a hero or a heroine or a, you know, an actual realized spiritual being or anything else, just as a soul person in disconnection from anybody else and what's going on with them. And I would love to hear your perspective, having grown up in the Native traditions, you know, before we kind of get to the whole constellation piece, of how we look at, you know, your website, which we'll talk more about later, is All My Relations Constellations. You know, how the, what is the Native view of who we are? Is it so incredibly individualized, and as we have come to, has been ingrained in us in our culture, or, you know, what is the perception? What is the difference in view?
Right. I think it's fundamentally different. I've been very fortunate when, probably when you were talking about the extension, looking back at the time that you've been involved in this type of conversation and this really looking at a bigger view. I think about 40 years ago, I was working at an Indian health clinic, and there was there were different instances where I saw that there might be a particular illness in the hands of Western practitioners, and there would be a focus on treating a particular illness. But it wasn't until they began to incorporate context, seeing, for instance, if a diabetic person was in flux and having a lot of trouble normalizing their blood sugar, the important thing became what's actually happening in their family system, what's happening in their home, what's happening in their life, what's today. Is it an anniversary of a loss in their family? Is it is there something happening in the greater context in society, for instance, at the moment that is kind of bringing up things for them that are having an impact on their body? And so coming from a clinic setting that was really working with indigenous population or Native American multiple tribes, but it became really clear in that context, because there was a cultural component, that that greater context had everything to do with how the body worked. So the idea of context was important for Western society to be able to really implement, to be able to effectively treat people that lived in or that were part of extended family systems. I think that there is, and I've worked just a small amount with Aboriginal people from Australia, from South Africa, from Canada, from the United States. I think that I also talk about a universal Indigenous. All of us actually have our roots in the tent. And the nuclear family, the degree of isolation that we have is so new. And in the newness, even in the newness, we can see that it's not entirely effective for human beings, because one of the things that we have is pathologies that are created that have to do with things like loneliness and isolation, complicated grief where people don't have a context for bereavement, a number of things that come as a result of us believing somehow, and I think it is just a belief. I think it's not our human reality, but a belief that we somehow are independent of each other, and particularly of our families,
mm-hmm.
because the Indigenous perspective, I think perhaps universally, is that the first thing is, I couldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you if I didn't have blood pumping in my veins.
Mm-hmm.
And that blood is not my own invention. That blood comes as a result of all of the successes, all of the failures, all of the presence and absence of thousands of generations of people who came before me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I speak with you, I know that the same is true for you sitting there, for the same is true for the people that are listening with us, that all of us are not created in isolation. And so I'm not from a Western psychotherapeutic background by intention, because there are some things that I really fundamentally find to be in some conflict with Indigenous thinking, and one of the things is the focus on pathology.
Mm-hmm.
So in my perception, and I think in a more Indigenous perception, we really are carried in such a great context, such a huge context, and such a reliable context, that somehow whatever people were able to do and whatever they couldn't do, you and I can sit here and have conversation because they absolutely survived it all.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is somehow an awe, not a criticism, but an awe of all of the people who ever came before me, whatever their human frailties, that
mm-hmm.
somehow, again, in a greater context, in the context of creation, there was some decision, some agreement, some mandate that I would be able to be here for this time, and that you would be able to be here, and all of us would be able to be here, and who knows for what reason engage in this conversation.
So, you know, just thank you. Just the way you've described that, you know, really you're actually creating, you know, as you described in the clinic, looking to the context for the person who is experiencing symptoms of illness. But you're basically also, you're saying that this context is really surrounding us at all times. So this kind of heroic effort to program my mind to positive thoughts, or you know, do these other things,
right,
is actually an act of though well-intentioned and well-meant, perhaps it springs out of a fundamental misunderstanding or experience that has been created in a social context where people are isolated,
right,
and therefore are struggling heroically to kind of survive and function and connect and do all the good things of life, experience joy, have families on their own. And that that's a when the resource on some level, and that's what we'll talk about more as the program begins, on some level of all that has come before is both is with us still, biologically, as you point out, also in terms of even the, you know, I often think about the land, the earth, the place that generates the air and the water and the food and the light and the heat, the energy, all that we need to live and create shelter and everything else. Actually, I am, I think, and I'll make a confession here to you, friend, which is I contemplate this a great deal because my mom got our family, she found and, you know, my family was able to purchase many years ago when it was quite inexpensive, a little summer house. And this place happened, and that's where I'm doing the show from today. And this happens to be on in the native town of an island off the east coast of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, so I'm always aware that this house, which is, and this home, you know, this terrain that surrounds me is owned temporarily now, in our time, borrowed in effect. But as part of what has always been, and this could be said for all of the United States, in fact, native land.
Right.
But in this particular area, it so happens that it was so designated, and so it retains that awareness and character of that root.
Right. Well, and I think that you're acknowledging that is something that I think that in the United States we have some people that have come and worked in this country call it an American amnesia.
Mm-hmm.
That for many people there's not that context or that recognition that you're talking about. And for myself, when I go to other places, even within the United States or in another country, what I do is say to the people of that place, I'm here and this is your home. This was your home first. And so I ask your permission to be here, and I honor that you were here, and I remember you. And then I'm very aware that, again, within context, people who are living there today are usually born in that place, and there's not any personal animosity. There's no personal connection. No personal activity involving atrocity in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that comes up with systems constellation is that we find that, and you know this well for folks when you've facilitated and when you've been in constellations, there are folks, and that's one of the beauties of this work, that really carry some sort of residual because of particular atrocities. They may feel a sense of guilt. They may feel really sort of lackluster or perhaps even a sense of aggression, somehow carrying a kind of vibration or a kind of echo of whatever those initial traumas were in regard to taking of the land or relocating of people. So that element that you talk about where you recognize this is my home, this was my mother's home, and before that, this is the story of the land, what we see is that the land recognizes when someone says that. And I think that that's something that comes from indigenous field that's been a really, for me, just a very organic fit with constellation, and it is including the land as a part of who we are and what we do. And I see that there are some folks now that there's with the University of Notre Dame, there's a peace studies department, and one of the things that they do to help people that have had trauma with combat situations and,
mm-hmm.
and horrible conflicts
mm-hmm.
is that they really begin to help people that have post-traumatic stress by simply taking them into nature.
Mm-hmm.
And Angwin St. Juste, who's a prolific author that writes, again, about context, is
mm-hmm.
another person that, since the Vietnam War, has been using nature, inviting nature, to work with people to help them heal. So
mm-hmm.
for folks that have been so traumatized that they really have no place of safe relationship with people
mm-hmm.
to introduce a representative of nature who
mm.
can hold them and who can bond, essentially bond with them in really a conscious and voluntary way, which is, I think, another indigenous definition, and I could say universal indigenous because some people, even if they're not from a recent tribal background, have really a sense of that, this participation, this co-creation that nature can have with us.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this element of really, I think it's beautiful the way that you don't, in your show and in your life, you don't separate a call for action for the land from a conversation about personal well-being, that they really are integrated, that they're interwoven, that we're sharing the same breath in a reciprocal way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I love that you do that very much, and perhaps that's some of the indigenous thinking that does have a place in constellation work and seems to have a really positive outcome.
Well, you know, I really love your use of the term universal indigenous, because that also suggests that that this is something that everyone can tap into, and I think there are many people all over the world of all over the environmental world, because I am very connected to environmental people in the field of environmentalism, of environmental psychologists, mm-hmm. psychologists who love and reverence the environment. And there is a lot of, there's a high value and resonance toward indigenous view, indigenous ritual, and nature reverence, and all of that within that expanded field of people that I know and am connected with. But one of the things that, I feel that this land, this particular land with, you know, with which my family has had I don't want to say how many decades because I'll date myself, but let's just say since, you know, childhood, my childhood, we've had this connection, and it has felt as if the land itself has, I've come to realize actually that the land itself has somehow taught, or given this, it has been the context. Mm-hmm. And it's a strange thing because, you know, I'm a very brainy, mental New York Jewish girl. But I also have that connection very deeply rooted, and actually I've personally kind of had to try to understand all of these things in order to come to terms with it for my own life, and looking at my interests and where I've evolved and the things that I champion, it really feels very much inspired, and yet, you know, I would feel embarrassed to claim my actual ancestral roots are Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
When you use a term like universal indigenous, you actually provide a context for people like me who do not have, as far as we know, native blood in our bloodlines, but who nevertheless are, and it's more grounded than just merely saying it's through spirit, although it is through spirit, spirit can also be sound detached if apart from the natural world in a certain kind of way. And I'm saying this, it's both personal, but I also know that many other people have this experience, and your term universal indigenous is actually a wonderful, it creates this beautiful wide circle or tent for all of the many people, and I think more and more all the time, who are coming to feel that resonance and feel part of that. Thank you.
And actually, when you say circle, that is one of the things, because as I spoke with and met and began to learn as much as I could about various indigenous fields or historical fields, there are some things that seem to be really uniform in humankind, and one is basically the circle. Mm-hmm. So for whatever the reasons, there have been for many centuries people who sat in circles with the intention of finding some sort of solution, clarity, coming together. So there began to be certain threads that I saw that were really consistent regardless of the culture, regardless of the continent, another one was smudging. So burning some sort of herb or some sort of plant is something that's done really worldwide. And I have, over the years, because it's one of the things that I began to notice and speak about, I've been gifted from many, many places in the world different things that were burned in different cultures. So there are particular herbs that grew in Switzerland. When bergamot is one of those. There is impepo, I believe is the name, a huge series of different types of herbs in South Africa that are burned that actually have very specific properties. So one might be to invite the ancestors, one might be to solicit calm. There's a wonderful man that I met in Germany, or not directly, but knew of him and had a wonderful exchange with email with he and his wife, and he contributed to connecting to our ancestral past because he happens to have a PhD in ethnobotany, and his name is Wolf-Dieter Stoll, and he speaks about the huge variety of herbs that were burned, including St. John's wort from the area around Germany, which was burned primarily when there was a lightning storm or when people really wanted to reinstitute a sense of calm. So I've found that there is something Chinese or Asian cultures. Someone gifted me with a beautiful chunk of natural charcoal that's used in their incense burning. And that's so there is something about the burning of these different elements that seems almost uniformly to have some resonance of conversation with the ancestors, whether it be entreating them or honoring them, recognizing them, appeasing them, that for whatever reason through all of the world there was some, as far as I know, and I continue to find more examples, and I'm sure that at some point I may find an exception, but there is this element that seems to be something that human beings used to really create a sense of calm, a sense of balance, a sense of remembrance. And it's one of those things that we've really assigned the label of superstition, or as with many of the different kinds of older wisdoms or wisdom traditions, it's something that we've really relegated to a sort of a no man's land. And yet, it looks as though if it was that uniform, there has to be probably also some universal validation for it. And so when we look, it changes ionization in the air. It, all of them have some kind of olfactory trigger that has the capacity to increase the kind of brain chemistry that helps us have a sense of calm and helps us be able to sort of take a breath for a moment. And then if one thinks in an indigenous term, perhaps, who's to say, there is also this expanded element of a kind of a respect for or an opening, a humility in relationship to the ancestors and a welcoming all of the resources that they bring for us and acknowledging that their challenges really were theirs. And I can't have the, I guess you could say, the audacity to pretend that I could carry something for them when I didn't experience it in my own life. It's really not, in a way, respectful to say that I am really in the place where I could carry the kinds of experiences that they've had. So I can instead, in those times when there's smudging, and of course it could happen all the time, but it seems as though somehow, very often for many cultures, there was sort of this invitation for a particular kind of conversation about all of those concepts that came along with burning these particular herbs. I think that we have a connection to it because there was a woman who had some distress, and I encouraged her because I think I also believe a great deal in our capacity to heal, that it's part of how we're made. Mm-hmm. And I encouraged her, if it felt comfortable for her, to find out, was there anything that called to her personally to burn? Because I wasn't familiar with her culture, and I wasn't really in a place that I wanted to say, this is what you should burn, or this is what you should burn. So she really thought about it, and for whatever reason, she had planted a particular herb consistently for years mm-hmm. and years and years where she lived. And so she said when she really walked around and thought about it, she decided to burn that. And it turns out that when I researched that, her people of origin, her country of origin, women in that country, in that place, would burn that specific herb for finding a sense of equilibrium, for supporting their place in life as a woman.
That's fascinating.
So intuitively, somehow, her family system, her field knew, planted it forever, and when she burned that herb, she was really burning it within the context of her whole ancestral field.
Unbelievable. That's amazing. We're gonna have to take a station identification break here, but that is a wonderful, wonderful contemplation to leave our listeners with. Stay with us, listeners, for further conversation with Francesca Mason Boring here on Connect the Dots. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm speaking today with Francesca Mason Boring. As we launch into the second part of the show, I'm going to connect you with some ways to connect with Francesca as well as with me, because I love to end the show on the conversation more so than, you know, kind of a long list. So that way we do that now, and I'm sure listeners who've been listening to the first part of the show will want to know how to connect more with Francesca Mason Boring and her amazing wisdom. She has a website, allmyrelationsconstellations.com. Constellations is spelled C-O-N-S-T-L-L-A-T-I-O-N-S. And there you can find her calendar, her training schedule, as well as a link to get a copy of her new book, Connecting to Our Ancestral Past, Healing Through Constellations, Ceremony and Ritual, A Native American Perspective. So all that we have been discussing and will discuss for the remainder of the show comes out of her amazing experience traveling the world, doing the kind of collective healing work that Francesca does through family constellations as ritual and from her Native American perspective. So that's those are ways that you can read her book. You can get involved in some of the constellations she offers as she travels, as well as connect with other resources through her website, allmyrelationsconstellations.com. And listeners are also invited to sign in to receive emails and announcements and read the blogs on my website, healthjournalistblog.com. You know, so returning to our conversation, you know, in the end of the first part of the show, Fran, you were talking about burning of herbs, smudging, the combination of, you know, kind of plant, fire, air, and ether all coming together, and how that's a way of creating clearing and accessing in some kind of way the field of the ancestors. I just wanted to share a tiny anecdote of a wonderful film I just saw last night, which I highly recommend. It's called Beasts of the Southern Wild, and it's an amazing story of a very rustic tiny tribe tiny self-created indigenous tribe almost, living down south of New Orleans in the Delta area. It's actually a dramatic film, but about those peoples. And in one scene, they have a lot of earth wisdom and practicality and visceral knowledge of how to survive in a very primitive way on the land, and they live by the sea. There's one woman in the little extended family that's featured as part of this dramatic film, who's the medicine woman, and she has a big collection of herbs, and at one point sends off the little six-year-old heroine of the film to bury in the woods a jar of some of the herbs that she's collected. Later, when the little girl's daddy falls ill, she goes and gets that large jar of herbs, wanting to help her father, and brings it home, but doesn't know what to do with the herbs. You know, such a beautiful, incredible metaphor of how we've lost some of the connection that you're now recreating through your sharing with us on the show and in your book and other work. And so she takes this large jar of herbs and just pours it on her father's face.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and of course he just kind of sputters and coughs, and you know, the intention is great, but it you know, the knowledge of how to smudge, as you're talking about, or what to put in a medicinal tea or soup, you know, how to release it into water for mm-hmm. intake in the body, how to release it into the air and ether through burning.
Mm-hmm.
Is lost, but I hesitate to say this, but you know, because I don't want to spoil the film for people, but ultimately the matter is the healing and the resolution does come about through burning finally, you know, and I won't go into greater detail about that. So you know what you've been sharing, even you know through the notion of smudging, is actually giving a sense that something still exists
mm-hmm.
on an etheric, maybe not quite a material level, but not as abstract a level as the total cosmos, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
and that in that in-between place, you know, not visible but still present, is somehow where the ancestral resonance resides. And so I want to go a little bit into that with you, because that's the place that you work from and that we work from when we do family constellations. So can you talk a little bit about that, just to make sure we include that here in the show?
Very sweet. Thank you for that. I wrote the film down. That sounds like something I definitely want to watch. One of the things that I think might be a little different that does come from our universal indigenous or personal tribal background is that when working with family constellation, because it is a method where we look at what are the possible entanglements that we have with our familial or ancestral field, where are the places that we believe that we're wounded when in fact we're simply carrying, out of love, caring for someone else, really just the residual of their pain. And so one of the things that comes from an indigenous field that is distinct and that is a little bit different is that when working with the ancestral field or working in constellation, I don't consider ancestors a metaphor or allegory or archetype.
Mm-hmm.
I really have a sense and a conditioning and experientially have a concept or a belief or a sense that the ancestors are in fact present. As much as they're present in your blood and my blood, they're also present in our field and have the capacity to be benevolent. And so when I'm facilitating constellation myself, and also the way that I teach family constellation, it's within that context
mm-hmm.
that we have really somewhat what you were describing, sort of the actual access to this connection to something that is not completely ethereal, something that really is very earth-based and very real. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's exciting because we're at a time when there are so many disciplines that are coming up with conversations that allude to that. Mm-hmm. So if someone wants to talk about a genetic memory, or if they want to talk about morphogenetic fields, or there are just a tremendous number of conversations coming out of quantum physics where there is what you so much are engaged in talking about, which is connection, where these connections are not just imagined. They're not anything that needs to be forced. Mm-hmm. They really are a part of our biological and physiological reality. So mm-hmm. when I'm working with constellation, my sense is that that it's important to be respectful and to invite the ancestors of the people who are participating. The thing that comes out of that is that very often there is a sense that the ancestors do participate in a positive way, in a benevolent way. And so when we see those connections and when we have it in the context of ceremony, which is really every minute of every day, our conversation right now is a ceremony. The mm-hmm. people who are listening, some of them are in a state of openness and resolution, and so they're having a ceremony. You and I are having a ceremony. And when we're through with this conversation, the way that you drive home or the way that I go about my day, we really have the option to continue to stay in that space. Mm-hmm. I also really appreciate when you were speaking earlier, something to that effect, that we really have this possibility to not have things so fragmented and so separated, so much in isolation. So when we work in an indigenous way in constellation work, then that is one really fundamental difference, because I think that there are some facilitators who are doing very beautiful work, and it's very, very well structured, and people can also still find very clearly resolutions in terms of changing and shifting their understanding of what is truly theirs and what really, with great respect, needs to be left with the people that they come from.
Mm-hmm.
But there is somehow a difference in the interpretation that mm-hmm. that there is no actual participation of ancestors, there is no presence, and that that's actually not a possibility. So I think that that's probably a cultural paradigm, but it's not really exclusive to Native people. When I was in Germany one time and did a workshop, there were amazing experiences that people had that had very much a quality of ancestral presence. And a woman spoke with me afterward and said, when I went home, I sat down and I felt very happy, and I decided I'm going to pour myself a cup of tea. So I sat and I got my tea ready and I took the cup and I started to pour it, and I thought, today this doesn't feel right. And so I went and I got another cup. And I had a tea with my ancestors. And so I think that if someone dares to have that possibility as a concept, that there is a reciprocity, there is a very nurturing kind of experience that people often have. And I don't think it requires a facilitator. The connections to our ancestral past, part of that book came out of my sense that we have so much wisdom. Individually, we have such a huge capacity, and when we have access to our ancestral field and all of that knowing, which is a huge pool of knowing, then we can do so many things that really help support our path, you know, really help create our health, well-being, generosity, all the things that can help us as a part of a community. So in connecting to our ancestral past, there are, I'm very grateful, there are voices of Native elder, a Native elder who happens also to be a psychologist, some wonderful women that worked in Mexico with indigenous communities and created a beautiful communal ritual to help young people who were having difficulty in school. And there's a traditional healer that's from Canada that contributed, and a number of people that allowed me to interview them and introduce some of the concepts and some of the traditions that they have in their tribal background that are very, very parallel to different things that are done in constellation work.
That's fascinating. You know, I wanted to ask you something because we're actually coming down to the end of the show, and I just want to say that it's clear that, you know, I would love to have you back on Connect the Dots because this is so rich and it's such a framework for all of the other things that that people are doing to protect the earth, to heal themselves and others, to restore balance to our societal structures, all of that. And this is part of the larger context of resource that people can't really be reminded of too often. So I very much would like to have you back again on the show, Fran, to, you know, because I really regard it as a major contribution to kind of, you know, through radio to connect people to this sense of resource. But one thing that comes up for me is that the sense that the ancestors are nearby and, you know, can be called on or interested in helping, you know, goes against some religious beliefs that are very prevalent that that people hear, like, you know, for example, that one should let go of those who are passing, allow them to go far away on their journey, not try to keep them close in any way, but release them. My aunt, my uncle died this past year, and my aunt was given this advice by some of the caregivers, and she was very feisty about it. She's in her 80s, and she said, I am not going to let him go. I will not be better off when he is gone. I don't want him to go far, far away. I, you know, she just wasn't having any of that. You know, but one hears a lot of that kind of thing, so that in calling up, so that there's almost a sense of, oh, I'm bothering a soul on its journey if I am calling forth the ancestors. I'd love to hear your comment on that.
Well, I think that this is really a primary place where there's a bit of a conflict in cultural paradigms, and yet that conflict is so new. It is so new because really up until the introduction of things like Western psychotherapy, I think that all of us have anecdotes in our family where there were people who were known who did have relationships still with people who had already passed. So until we had to really enlist other people outside of our family system to support our well-being, that's another thing that seems to have been really universal, that people in general had a concept of their connection with ancestors. So I think that there is a bit of a leap in terms of our current cognitive lexicon, what our definitions are, that it is for some people initially a bit of a step. However, if we consider that our family field, our family ancestry is contained within a field that goes back thousands of generations, the bulk of that field is very comfortable with that conversation. So we have this, just this very recent anomaly that says that that is some sort of aberration or delusion is another one that I think that is a concern, that that it is often pathologized if people are connected with their ancestors. And so I think that initially there's a bit of daring, and yet it seems as though there's something so organic, and my supposition is that perhaps it is because the bulk of the field is really comfortable with that connection.
Beautiful. Well, that is our final word for this edition of Connect the Dots. And
thank you so much, Allison. I really admire your work, and I really appreciate the conversation.
Well, come back again. Come back again. I hope you will, and I'm sure our listeners hope you will. I'd love to have you back on again. And please, listeners, all my relations, constellations, and connecting to our ancestral past. Thank you, Francesca Mason Boring, and thank you, listeners, for being with us this week. And stay tuned next week, Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time every week, with me, Allison Rose Levy, on Connect the Dots on the Progressive Radio Network.
Mm-hmm.